Mr. Grande, we've talked about a lot of people's names, and I apologize in advance, but I may jump around a little bit. I want to go back now to your initial walkthrough, but when you observed the inside of the apartment, and specifically when you were talking about the shower, and you showed us three photographs, one, 143, you showed the shower head, and 144 is sort of the lower part of the shower, Now, I don't suppose you have 144 handy. We could just show that to you here. Thanks. Now, it appears that the wall shown in 144 is kind of separated into two color shades. Would that be the delineation in between those two shades? Would that be the corner of the shower?
You mean right there?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Now, that's not a particularly clear photograph.
Because of the, on this material, blown out, probably not super clear.
It's really pretty hard to say based on that photograph alone whether there's wetness or dampness on the wall of the shower.
If you were to look only at that photograph, I would agree.
And it's been nearly 6 years since you went into the scene with the incident. And Bonnie Wilder is the one who actually took the photographs, right?
Yes.
And I'm going to represent to you that in earlier testimony last week, Ms. Wilder said that her recollection was that there was dampness or wetness on the shower wall up about a foot from the bottom. Were you aware of that?
I'm not aware of her testimony, no.
Okay. And you will agree that there was a plastic bag outside of the shower that was wet.
Yes.
And that some clothing that was inside the shower was wet.
Correct.
Okay. And you, I believe, testified earlier that the shower itself was not leaking.
From my recollection, no.
So any water that would have been in the bottom of that shower would have been residual from the last time the water was turned off. Is that a fair conclusion?
I suppose.
You talked briefly about some serology testing that you did on the white tennis shoes that were attributed to being Mr. Matt's tennis shoes. And you said that you used, I may pronounce this incorrectly, but chemiluminescence with star.
Correct.
Okay. And you use that to try to make trace amounts of blood that you can't see with the naked eye visible?
Yes, the blue star is used for when no visible blood is present. You suspect that there may be potential visible or potential blood there. You can treat it with blue star and see if a reaction occurs.
Okay. And the reaction that occurs is a sort of fluorescence?
Yes.
Does the blue star use the same, does it react with the same things that the KM test reacts with?
Well, it reacts because Castlemyre works based off of the peroxidase activity at the heme, which is similar to what is happening with blue star. That same peroxidase activity in the heme is what's causing the chemiluminescence of blue star.
Okay. And when you were talking about the KM test, You said that there were other things besides blood that it could react to, right?
Correct.
And one of those things were different plant materials.
Can be, yes. Anything that exhibits a peroxidase activity.
Okay. Did you, in this case, make any sort of determination whether the betel leaf juice reacted to either the KM or the blue star?
Could you repeat what kind of juice?
That you recall the jug that had the
yes,
and there were stains of that throughout the apartment.
Right.
Did you determine whether any of that reacted either to the KM or to the blue star?
I did not.
But you are aware that some plant materials can react or can cause a reaction from the KM.
Yes.
And because the blue star also is based on the hemoglobin, that may also cause a reaction.
The heme, which exhibits peroxidase-like activity, is what is causing that reaction. So I don't know. I'm not familiar with if any kind of plant material with peroxidase activity caused blue star to react. I'm not familiar with that portion, or I've never tested plant material with blue star. I know blue star will react with other things. It's not specific to blood. You know, it's a presumptive type test as well. But as far as blue star reacting with plant material, I'm not sure of that.
Okay. So it's not specific to blood.
Right.
And you were unable to obtain any sort of DNA profile from these shoes.
That's correct.
So there's no further testing.
Right.
You talked a little bit about States Exhibit 105, which was the photograph of the denim jacket. You demonstrated how those blood drops were presumptive blood drops were all in the one, and four of them you actually found were blood drops.
Correct.
The four that were in one.
Correct.
And you tested the top one and the middle one.
Yes.
Okay. And when you did this examination of this jacket, you also very carefully tested the front of the jacket.
I examined it for any reddish brown stains, anything that would catch my eye to test chemically. Yes.
You did that in the same way that you did with the back.
Yes.
And you also very carefully tested the sleeves.
Yes.
And you found nothing to do further testing on either the sleeves or the front.
That's correct.
Now, do you have children?
I do.
Have you ever got down on your hands and knees and given them sort of a horse ride where you can be the horse and they run out of your
hands? Sure.
Is it possible if a child was engaged in that activity and had a bloody nose that the blood could fall in the spots in the lining on the back of the jacket?
We have a picture.
Is it possible? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't say that it's not, because it could be possible. If you're asking of my experience with my kids, you know, if I've had them on my back, their head is up towards my head or the top of my back, and knowing the bloody nose of a child and knowing that they don't quickly cover it up or anything, if they had a bloody nose, I would expect a lot blood to come out, and I would probably expect more to be on my back. But is your question is it possible? I would say it's possible. I don't know.
Certainly, if there was copious amounts of blood. But if you have less amounts of blood, you end up with some spots, right?
Sure.
Okay. You also conducted serology on the blue jeans that Isarmat was wearing.
Yes, I believe so.
And the result of that serology was that you could not find through your testing any indication of blood on the genes.
If I can just refer to my notes. That's correct. No indications of blood were found on those genes.
And you conducted some serology testing on the white T-shirt, the light-colored T-shirt that he was wearing.
Correct.
And you testified that there was a blood spot somewhere on the front of the shirt.
That's right.
Did you take any photograph or anything to document exactly where on that shirt that spot was?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, Coach.
Yes.
Okay.
Inside out. That's the inside.
And so we don't have a big picture of this, but you just showed me a sort of a thumbnail of a shirt that had a circle pretty much in the middle of the chest.
Yeah, as I indicated earlier, if I was to kind of show in my own body, it'd be right in this area, kind of close to your sternum, right in the center.
And you did a DNA analysis of that blood matched
the major profile of that did, yes.
And your analysis also excluded Saranamu as being the contributing to that blood.
Yes, and what I was looking at, so that report you have is my initial report, which was dated October 21st, 2008. Is that right?
It says submitted July 21, 2006.
How about on the very last page? October 21st, 2008.
Yes.
Okay. So, at that time, 2008, I did, in my report, wrote that I excluded Sernamu from that stain. Additional testing was done, and a report was generated that I dated June 28, 2013. There's a little bit of difference between those because I, during that time frame, our interpretation guidelines changed so that if you cannot apply statistics to a minor profile, meaning because in this statement I say V1 is excluded, but then I can't say much of anything else. But in this supplemental report that was dated later in June of 2013, I state that due to the level and complexity of the mixtures, no conclusions could be made regarding the possible minor contributors. And that's due to the interpretation guidelines changing, and that is that if I can't apply statistics to a minor profile because of the complexity or the possibility of alleles that are present but not being called or detected, so therefore I cannot apply a stat to them, therefore I cannot make any kind of conclusions based on those interpretation guidelines. So from 2008 to 2013, our interpretation guidelines changed, but originally I did exclude her based off on our current interpretation guidelines. I would state that no conclusions could be made regarding the minor contributor to that profile.
Okay. So is that the case, even if the short tandem repaints that show up in the minority profile belong to neither of the subjects you're testing?
Yes, because what I do when I'm examining a profile is before I make any comparison to any of the reference standards that have been submitted, so I'll make my conclusion off of the question sample. So as I look at it, and upon review in 2013, I look at that profile, see there's a major, see there's a minor, realize and recognize in my minor that there's too many areas that either low level or the complexity is too great that I can't apply any statistics before I make the comparison.
I realize this is the first test you did. This is a Profiler Plus test, and Q7 is the T-shirt. Is that right?
That's right.
And on Q7, we have here where it shows the alleles. Am I pronouncing that right?
Alleles. Yes.
14 and 15 on this fourth column.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go down to V1, which is certainly
correct,
that 14, 15, and then in parentheses 16.
Right.
And the parenthesis, or 16 in parentheses, is the minority or the minor profile.
Correct.
And if you look at Sarah Moon in that one, there's 14 and 18.
Correct.
And if you look at the subreddit, there's 14 and 15. Neither of them have the minor profile of the 16.
Correct.
And is that why the first time you did this, you excluded Sarah Moon? Because there was a level that didn't belong to either of them.
Right, because the first interpretation was because there were locations. If you remember, I explained when I look at a question sample, I'm looking for points of exclusion. So if I can find locations that her alleles aren't present, then that would be a point of exclusion. So that's, yes, originally that's the way we interpreted that profile.
And so it's just a question of you're going to exchange.
Right.
And the 14-15 there correspond perfectly with each of them.
Correct.
So clearly that's the majority profile. And at least the minority profile in that allows, there's a 16 there that doesn't belong to 7.
Right.
I apologize that I'm jumping back and forth a little bit here in serology and DNA.
No, that's okay.
But, in the serology portion of this, you received a sexual assault evidence collection
kit.
That's correct. And I'm showing you what has been marked as defendant's exhibit 1 for identification. Is that your serology report that summarizes the analysis, your analysis of the items contained in that sexual assault evidence collection?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And that kit contained vaginal swabbings and a slide.
Correct.
It contained oral swabbings and a slide.
Correct.
It contained rectal swabbings and a slide.
Correct.
Anal swabbings in a slide.
Yes.
And you checked for the presence of spermatozoa in each of those slides.
Yes.
And you checked for the presence of seminal fluid in each of those slides.
Yes.
And neither seminal fluid nor spermatozoa were found in any of those.
That's right.
Do it off of the defendant's exhibit one.
Any objection from the state?
I'm updating that. So,
was that an exhibit? You've marked that as an actual exhibit, have you not?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
You're going to write and object. Technically, this report is hearsay. We have the person who generated the report testifying as to his conclusions with regards to the report. I don't think it's.
Isn't that the type of report we regularly admit?
Yeah, we don't.
Crime lab reports relative to drug analysis, that sort of thing, these are typically admitted. For any, are you saying it's cumulative?
Well, we have certainly have had testimony now twice in regards to that evidence. So I don't think it's necessary.
It's admitted.
Thank you. You also conducted serology analysis on the child's underwear that was found in the base of the shower.
Correct.
And you found no indication of seminal fluid on the underwear.
And the underwear.
That's correct.
And you found, excuse me, you examined the pink shirt.
Correct.
And found no indications of seminal fluid on the I misspoke. I said I'm sure I meant to say skirt. This you examined the pink skirt, which was South Salt Lake number 61495.
Yes, I believe that's the correct item number.
And you found no indications of seminal fluid on the skirt item.
That's correct.
Mr. Grundy, if a person is forcibly raped, the vaginal swab contains skin cells of the assailant as well as
Yes.
Could the DNA analysis of the swab reveal the DNA of the assailant based on that touch DNA rather than say the deposit seminal fluid?
It could.
Were you ever requested to perform a DNA analysis of the vaginal swab of seminal fluid?
I was not.
Or of
animal
swab?
No. No.
If children are playing, let's say, physically interacting, playing tag or whatever games children play, is it possible to get one another's skin cells on your fingernails?
Sure, it depends on the play, what you're doing. Lots of different scenarios there, but it's possible.
If I inadvertently scratched you and got some of your skin cells under my fingernails, could those cells be present in sufficient quantity to obtain a YSTR DNA profile?
I believe so.
Could that profile still be sufficiently present a day later?
I think it would vary on your activity, what you do, once you've scratched me, or in the scenario, if you wash your hands, if you, are handling other items, or depending on what you're doing with your hands. I think a lot of different scenarios play into that.
And it could, potentially it could be present even a week later, depending on the scenarios that you suggest.
It could be.
Now, DNA is pretty resilient, isn't it?
Can be.
When you clean your instruments, your DNA testing instruments, you have to take special precautions that things don't get cross-contaminated.
Right.
And when you do that, you don't just use soap and water.
Right.
You use a bleach solution?
Depending on what we're cleaning or trying to sterilize, we'll use bleach solution. Sometimes we use an ethanol solution to clean. Sometimes we use UV light to sterilize tubes and things like that. Or
you don't. All of those things are things that you wouldn't commonly expect someone to do washing their hands.
No, I wouldn't.
So, is it possible that a perfunctory hand washing by a child is not going to guarantee that DNA cells or skin cells under the fingernails will not be present after the hand washing?
Again, I think it varies on how you wash your hands, how often you wash your hands, those types of things.
Now you talked a little bit about the difference between the STR and YSTR. Did you talk a little bit about that here today?
No.
You didn't describe the differences there. But that is something you're qualified to talk about.
I believe so, yes.
And the YSTR testing is a tool that's best used for exclusion. Is that correct?
YSTRs are very useful in situations where you have a lot of female DNA and maybe not a lot of male DNA. Because what YSTR is targeting, as the name describes, is the Y chromosome. If you remember back through some of our earlier slides, female is XX and the male is XY. So Y portion comes only from males. So their YSTR testing is very useful. And there's a lot of female, a little bit of male, and you're just wanting to target that male profile.
Okay. And a significant difference between YSTR DNA and STR DNA would be that YSTR DNA, two males can have the same YSTR DNA.
Males in your family lineage, so son, father, grandfather, great grandfather, will all have the same exact YSTR profile. That Y chromosome is passed down through the father, so that's why all the males in the family line would have the same YSTR profile.
So potentially, if you go back 50 generations, I would have the same YSTR as a male progenitor
is a
generation back.
It could, yes, unless there had been any type of mutation that long ago. But
and potentially the male descendants of that progenitor would also have that same YSTR profile.
Right, if they're all in the family line.
So potentially there could be literally millions of people with the same YSTR profile that I have.
However many generations your family line goes back.
Now, I've asked Mr. Jansen to show a slide for me here, a slide that you looked at earlier. And and this is a slide that shows Exhibit 47 and Exhibit 82. And we're talking specifically about the item that you tested that was listed as Q2.
Okay.
Now, looking at the Exhibit 82 portion of this slide, I think you testified earlier that appears to you to be blood spatter. Is that accurate?
It does, and with the knowledge that we performed the Castlemyer test and it was positive, led me to believe that that would, well, Castlemyer positive meaning it, that there's indications of blood, so yes.
Is there anything to lead you to believe that this might have been juice from that beetle juice?
Nothing that points out specifically to be that. Like I said, the Castlemyer was positive, so that gives me indications that could be blood, and further testing showed that that was human blood.
And just looking at the pattern, it looks a lot more like blood spatter than spit, doesn't it?
From my experience in the bloodstain courses I've taken, yes, but I've also seen some spit that could kind of resemble that in some way. Got a lot.
And you testified that you tested that stain, or at least a portion of that stain. Not only for the Castlemyer, you discovered that it had the traits of blood, but you did a DNA test.
Right.
An STR test.
Right.
And the STR test, unlike the YSTR, it can be specific to an individual.
Right.
You discovered in that stain both a major profile and minor profile.
Correct.
And so to you, this merely means that there's the DNA of more than one individual.
Right.
And you identified that the major profile of this blood belonged to sermon.
Correct.
And you also identified that the minor profile, not in your examination today, but in your report when you did this examination, you said that the minor profile does not match you, Sarmat. Is that correct?
And again, because there are two reports, the original report, yes, in the original report, I excluded Isar Met as a possible contributor to that stain. And then in my later report, where our interpretation guidelines changed, the minor profile, so due to the level of complexity of the mixture, no conclusions could be made regarding contributor to the minor.
Would you, if you have it handy, would you take a look at your profiler plus chart that you did in the first testing of this?
Okay.
And starting in the third column down, well, let's just for clarification for the jury, and I'm sorry I don't have a way to project this chart here. The first two columns, the first one is the item number that's being tested, right?
Right, the Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4 on that first column.
And also the standards are Serenu and Nisar.
Correct.
And the second one is the column that denotes whether the contributor is male or female.
Right.
And so then when we start with the third column, the rest of those columns are specific alleles that you're looking at. To come up with the profile.
Right, so the columns are the locations. So if you remember, across the top was the loci, and then down the column is the allele calls.
And looking at that third column in Q2, the major profile shows STRs at 15 and 17. Or 15 and 17 STRs, those loci.
Correct.
And both the Sarmat and Serenu have an identical profile of that loci.
Correct.
But there's a minority profile that shows a 16.
Right.
And that belongs to neither Sarmat nor Serenu.
Correct.
And in the next column over, the next loci, we have majority profile 14 and 18, correct?
Yes.
And those match the majority profile of Serenu.
Right.
And then we have a minor profile of 16 again. which matches neither ESAR nor SAR.
Correct.
And in the next column, I'm just going to skip over the major profiles just for the sake of brevity.
Okay.
But the minor profile there, you have 19 and 20.
Right.
And while 20 matches one of ESAR's profiles, 19 matches neither ESAR nor SARB.
Correct.
And in the next column, you have a loci with 13 STRs that matches neither ESAR nor SARB.
Right, there's the minor is a 12-13, and also notice the star next to that. So the star, we use a star to indicate, you can't see really well on the chart up there, but a star indicates that there's some activity below our calling threshold, so there's some other type of potential allele or a possible allele that's below our calling threshold. So that gives me indication that there may be another allele in there, but just not high enough that I can call.
Okay, and then this isn't an exhibit. This is just a So, in any event, the same point that I wanted to make is that that's the reason that you excluded ESAR match being a contributor to Q2 in the original test because you have these profiles that fit neither in nor SARB.
That's correct.
Now, you testified today about some additional testing that you did on Q12. Now, on Exhibit 47, where was Q12 located at in the apartment? Do you happen to have? That's the first.
Q12 is the human blood swab from the west wall.
Exhibit 47. Okay, so where can you show with your marker where Q12 was?
Q12 is
right here. So, if I understand correctly, that's on the wall at the bottom of the stairs?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so, and you, when you did your testing with respect to that spot or that stain, you excluded ESAR mass as being a contributor to that spot?
Yes, I did.
And if my memory is right, you also excluded Sarah Miller as being a contributor to that spot, is that right?
No.
She was a part
Conclusion from that is that human blood stain from the west wall is a mixture of more than one individual with no clear major or minor contributor, and that sample V1, who is Sernamu, and E2, who is Kunu, are consistent with that combined profile.
Okay. And Kunu, as you understand, it was one of the other roommates in the apartment.
Correct.
Now, you right at the beginning of the day today, you testified about a spot of blood or a spot that tested positive at the top of the upstairs level.
Yes.
Now that's not on the main level, but actually the upstairs level, main level being the kitchen and the living room, and the upstairs level being where the other room is.
I don't know who stayed up there, but yes, up the stairs on that one up there.
Okay. And that's in exhibit, that's demonstrated in exhibit 145 and 146. And you conducted this KM test, which I think you testified earlier is an indication that this could be blood.
Right.
And this was a scene of a child homicide.
Right.
And you didn't take any swabs. Did no further testing at that spot. Potentially blood.
That's correct.
Was there sufficient material in that spot to have conducted a DNA test had you taken a swab?
Yes.
But you didn't feel like it was necessary because it was far away from the other evidence that you wanted?
Well, as I kind of explained earlier, as we walked through that initial walkthrough and scene, we saw reddish-brown stains. We noticed that one at the top. As we decided where to concentrate our efforts in processing the crime scene, seeing all the reddish-brown liquid that was upstairs and the distance between where the victim was found, flight of stairs, middle level, another flight of stairs to where that drop was found. No other indication along that stairwell moving up or in any of those other rooms that we saw any type of blood trail or anything like that along those stairs. We felt like that separation meant that the crime scene was from that main level down, so that's where we concentrated our efforts.
But if you had analyzed that, you would have known whether that blood or that spot was blood first, right?
Correct.
And you would have been able to tell whether that spot, if it was blood, belonged to Sarah Moon.
Potentially, yes.
Or if it was even a combination of the blood of Sarah Moon and someone else.
Correct.
But because you didn't take that swab, we have no way of knowing.
That's correct.
And you didn't prepare any formal report that you provided to the district attorney's office indicating that that spot that you had tested, that the KM test indicated that spot could potentially be one.
No, my crime scene report basically states generalities of things that we did at the scene. So in my crime scene report, it states that we arrived at scene, we processed the scene, did some Castlemyre testing, collected evidence, those types of things, but nothing specific regarding testing that we did is in that report.
But you kept personal notes that you didn't turn over to the district attorney. It indicated to you that did test positive on the Castlemyre test.
I have my crime scene notes, which we collect and maintain during the processing. We don't release any of our notes unless we are given a grandma request by defense or prosecution. So, no, I did not produce those notes to anybody, which is not something we do ever. Unless we were given a grandma request.
Not even in a child homicide scene.
If they're requested that we're given our reports out, which states what we did, but if our actual notes are requested, they are government records, so they can be obtained by prosecution or defense or whoever needs them. But a grandma request, which is a government record, I'm not sure what it all stands for, but can be supplied to the laboratory, and then those notes can be supplied to whoever is making that request.
When you prepare your reports for the district attorney, you expect the district attorney to be able to rely upon the fact that anything that had evidentiary value would be in that report.
Well, first of all, I just want to clarify, my reports are generated for the agency. So South Salt Lake PD is the agency that submitted the evidence to us. So the reports I generate, I give to them, which oftentimes end up to the the prosecution, or they can call and we can, you know, supply them. So, and then ask me the question again. I'm sorry.
My mistake. Let me rephrase the question. You expect South Salt Lake Police Department to be able to rely on the fact that you're going to put everything of evidentiary value in the reports that you generate?
Not necessarily.
So you expect the district attorney's office or the defense office to have to do a grandma request to find out what has evidentiary value?
No, but in our reports, and I'm trying to see, I don't think it's listed in the crime scene report, so there may be, but in my general report, serology and DNA, we put a statement that the above interpretation does not represent the totality of the forensic scientist's observation and conclusion. Further discussion and or questions are encouraged. So that's kind of the, I guess, mentality I look at is, this is a report, especially crime scene, because we can't specify every single thing that we've done. We do the best we can to give a situation report as to what we did, kind of the basic situation, but encourage further discussion, which after processing a crime scene, you know, usually happens with follow-up. As the agency submitting the evidence to us, especially homicide cases, we'll meet with detectives, crime scene people, our lab personnel, and discuss what needs to be done, what's most probative in the case, those types of things.
So if the district attorney can guess what might be important that was left out, that we're okay. I have a little bit of that. So, you would have had time to swap that spot?
At the crime scene? Yes.
You take whatever time is necessary to thoroughly examine the crime scene?
Absolutely.
And you've been doing this for a while, quite well.
Well, in forensics since 2002.
And you were not just a crime scene technician, but you were the leader of the crime scene technicians on this crime scene.
That's correct.
And you knew that the entire apartment was constituted the crime scene.
Right. But also, if you do a kind of a comparison, if this courthouse was considered a crime scene because something happened on this level. As I would come in to process, I would check all levels, see that there's blood trail in this hallway, and I would concentrate that area. I would look at the different areas, but if there's no indication that the crime happened up on the fifth floor or no other, you know, things that lead me to believe that that crime has taken its place up there or gone up there, then I would narrow my crime scene. You set up a typical crime scene processing is you set up a wide perimeter as you start processing the scene and find evidence. You can narrow your perimeter and shrink it down until you have your main focus of the crime scene. And I feel like that's what I did in this situation where the whole apartment, yes, was considered the crime scene. But as I looked at what had happened, where the evidence was leading me, yes, there was, you know, potential blood stain on that landing, but one drop that tested positive for KM, no other indications of a blood trail up there. It's not uncommon to have a blood spot, you know, right next to a bathroom with multiple people that live in one home. So putting all of those things together, my logic told me the crime scene is from the main level down.
This is right, yeah, I understand. Nobody's open. But in this apartment, with no doors separating the upper level from the main level from the bottom level, if that spot had been tested, and if it were the blood of Sarah Booth, it would vastly affect the complexion of this case, would it not?
In my opinion, no.
Because you don't know where the roommate slept and where who slept where in that apartment.
Well, if you're asking my opinion, that bloodstain, her Cerner Moon's blood is in that apartment. So if that's her blood, and that's her blood, but I think there's more evidence pertaining to the jacket or things like that that have her blood on it that ties to a potential suspect.
Just one follow-up. Going back to Q2, which was the blood on the wall that you have to... major profile of Sarah Moon, the minor profile, you've now concluded you can't say what was, but it's originally excluded itself. Did you ever compare the minor profile in that sample to any of the other roommates where you ever compared that sample?
At the time that I wrote the report that stated June 28th, 2013, that's the date that I ran all those other buccal standards, which I think are included the roommates. And at that time, that's when our interpretations guidelines have changed. So when I reanalyzed that sample with our current interpretation guidelines and concluded that the minor profile is insufficient for comparison, I didn't make any comparison because of that interpretation guideline.
You mentioned that your reports have this various statement that says that individuals can call further, basically further inquiry into that. Do you also field inquiries from defense counsel?
Yes.
Going back to some questions you had that were posed to you with regards to skin cells and hand washing and so forth. And so we're talking about basically skin touch DNA. You said that washing, you know, depends on how the washing is done. Can just the simple motion of rubbing, rub off skin cells? So if I had somebody...
Are you talking about just on your hand?
Yeah, if I had DNA of another person on my hand and I rubbed it, would it come off?
It could.
What about the use of detergent? Would that help facilitate the removal of DNA that's another person's DNA?
Could.
And the frequency of washing, so if I had, you know, compared one washing to multiple washings from the time that DNA was placed out, would that also eliminate any DNA?
I would say yes, it would.
And multiple washings is in two or three or more?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put a number on it, but I think every time you wash your hands, you're, you know, without re-adding more DNA to it. If you're washing your hands often or occasional, you know, I don't know a number, but I think you would be washing away whatever DNA engine could be there.
And you mentioned previously with Castlemeyer and this Blue Star that was placing water on your sample diluted or degraded that DNA. And in fact, on the shoe, it, to the point where you couldn't
ever get. I did state that applying Blue Star will dilute a sample. So you're dealing with trace amounts of DNA. And spraying a water solution on top of that is diluting it, but it does not degrade it, does not destroy it. Also, Castlemyer is never applied directly to a stain like the Blue Star is. So Castlemyer is always swab taken of a potential stain, and then the swab tested. It's never directly...
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry about reference to Castlemyer. I guess I'm referring to the LCV and the black process.
Okay.
when you apply those type of things, which does have water, then it's more difficult to pull out DNA when you, once you've applied those type of things.
Yeah, because you're potentially diluting out the sample.
With a wall.
Right.
Now, if Isar Mek did not have his clothes on at the time that an event where Cernamu's blood was in the air, would you expect it to be on his pants?
Could you just state that again?
So if I have clothing, if there's an event occurring here where blood is over here, the clothing's over here, would you expect blood to be on the clothing?
Depending on the bloodshed, if it's being cast off or you know, force causing blood spatter to travel a certain distance, could be on there. But if you know, if these pants are far enough distance away or in a different room, then no, I would not expect.
And you talk about cast off, that would show up as a linear type of pattern.
Typically cast off, depending on the...
I don't think there's been sufficient foundation to show that this witness is a blood spatter expert, or they have any expertise in saying how blood would spatter, whether it would be in here or otherwise.
He's testified some of that. Sustain for the moment if you could lay for the foundation.
Certainly. So, from your training experience and what limited portion you have on blood spatter, can you indicate whether or not if blood is in motion, it would go in a trajectory fashion?
Sure. Yeah.
We've had no expert notice of this witness being an expert in blood spatter.
But he did. I mean, I'm trying to look at my notes relative to what is.
I asked him some common sense questions about.
Well, I've sustained it so far.
Okay.
And if I'm not getting an early foundation,
okay.
It's good again.
Okay.
With regards to, there was a question on the shower stall of yours looking at the photographs. There was some indication you're not aware of what Bonnie Wilder said in her testimony on the shower stall. But
right.
As to your memory and observation, there was no water on the walls in the shower stall.
That's correct.
And Ms. Wilder did state in her testimony that it was your responsibility or your job that day to document and write what you were observing. Is that an accurate indication of what your responsibility was?
Yes.
You were the one taking notes.
Right.
And according to your notes and your observations,
that's correct.
Thank you.
Wes?
Did you ever send a child to wash his hands only to have him come back and have visible dirt under his fingernails?
My own children? Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Jansen?
No.
All right, thank you.